allowed to go out the back door. We're light already. So we're going to do our gospel story tonight. Guess which story I might want to be interested in out of the gospel on a particular day. Yeah, we're going to do the resurrection out of Matthew chapter 28, since our minds are that direction anyhow. Seems reasonable. Matthew chapter 28. We're going to mostly limit ourselves to Matthew's account, although the first set of questions I'm going to ask is whether this matches up at all with the other accounts. But otherwise, we're mostly interested in just what Matthew has to say and how it fits into his gospel. Remember, all the gospel writers are giving you the same basic story, but the details they select, or that the Spirit guides them to select, if we'd rather say it that way, is to make the point that gospel's making, right? There's, as John says at the end of his gospel, there's more things that could be written than ever could be written, right? There's more things that Jesus did than we could ever write down. So why these details in this story? Why do we need it told like this, and what does it help us with? We'll start with the very first verse. If someone would read, raise your hand and read chapter 28, verse 1. Yes, Edwin, thank you.
Now after the Sabbath, as the first day of the week began to dawn, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary came to see the tomb.
I do have to tell you a little story that this morning in my third through sixth grade class, we're going over how the Bible came to us in kind of an abbreviated version of the how we got the Bible class in the auditorium, doing a much shorter version for that age group. And this morning's topic in the workbook I was given was about how the scribes copied and transmitted the Bible through the years. And so I'm thinking, okay, how do you convey that to a group of third through sixth grade students? You know, it's a pretty dense topic. And so I gave them all a blank sheet of paper and a Sharpie marker so they couldn't erase it, like the writing with ink on a parchment, right? They can't erase it. And I read to them very slowly Matthew 28, verse 1, and they were supposed to write it down like a group of scribes. And I think I may have kept some of them. You ought to read some of the stuff I got. I don't know what Bible they were listening to, and but there was some interesting stuff in there. So it makes the task of being a scribe apparently difficult. But anyway, we read that this morning. The detail here, most of the details are going to be the same as you would expect. This is after the Sabbath, so what day of the week is this? Sunday, the first day of the week. In fact, that's how Jewish reckoning even describes Sunday. It was the day after the Sabbath. That's the way they termed it, whereas we focus more on it being Sunday, the first day of the week. It was the after the Sabbath day, toward the dawn of the first day of the week, so it's early in the morning. First question I have is about the two people being here, Mary Magdalene and someone we're just going to get called Other Mary. How would you like to be the person who, for all of human history, will be remembered as that Other Mary? Anyway, don't know. So there's Mary Magdalene and that Other Mary. My first question is, who was at the tomb? Is Matthew's account different or the same or complementary or contradictory? Who was at the tomb? And if you want to cheat, you can look. Mark 16:1. Luke, the important verse is probably 24:10, and John 20 and verse 1. If you look in Mark 16:1, it will say that Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of Salome, and another person. See, I should look over there and look. No, Mary the mother of James and Salome. See, I combined two. That's why I couldn't think of it. So there's Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome. Luke has a whole bunch of women there, because there were a lot of women at the cross in Luke's account. But in particular, he calls by name Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Mary the mother of James, and the other women. And then John 20 and verse 1 is the one I remember. The only person mentioned in John 20 verse 1 is Mary Magdalene. So, what do you think? Same people, different people? Did they goof? you can guess my answer is not the gospel messed up. So what do you think? Edwin?
You have four different men writing about what they,
okay,
they saw. So each has maybe a different perspective.
Okay. So I'm going to make you work for it, Edwin. Yes, we have four different men writing down the accounts. But if one of them says the truck that hit me was blue and one of them says the truck that hit me was red, I don't care how many accounts you got, you know, it's, if it's completely different, then we have a problem. Are these close enough that you could say these are just four perspectives of the same event? Told you I'd make you work for it. It's not nice. Is there anything in those verses that was contradictory? No, I mean, John doesn't say Joanna wasn't there. Now, see, there I'd have a problem. If Luke says Joanna's there and John says, no, she wasn't, well, then we've got a problem, don't we? We've got a contradictory account. But what you have is just different lists. So Matthew says it's Mary and the other Mary. So Mary Magdalene's there in all of them, right? So check. That one's good. Matthew says it's the other Mary. Mark says it's Mary, the mother of James. Is there a contradiction in that? Both of them said there's somebody named Mary. One says it's the other one. One says it's the mother of James. And then there's two other women that are added in Mark and Luke. One says Salome was also there. One says Joanna was there. But Luke's pretty clear when he says, and the other women. But there were quite a few women there, apparently. But some were picked out and named, because they were of interest to somebody who might read that book. Whereas John doesn't say Mary went all by herself, but he just mentions Mary because that's the one who's interesting to his rendition of the story. So, yeah, you're on the right track. I think the answer is no, there's not any contradiction here. It's just a different way of telling the story. Go home tonight and try this one. Find, if you came here with your spouse or your kids or grandkids or whatever, ask them, who is at Bible class tonight? Well, they're going to say, well, most of them are going to say Ben was there, because it's kind of hard. It's obvious when I'm not there, right? Where was Ben? Okay. One of the kids in my third through sixth grade class asked his grandmother recently, if Ben's teaching our class, who's in the auditorium? And he was very deeply concerned. Anyway, they notice when I'm not there. Okay. But some of them will say, and I also saw James. And some of them will also say, you know, we've got a couple of Jerrys here, so if Jerry Morgan had been here this morning and Jerry Buller, one of them might say Jerry was there and the other Jerry, and one might say just Jerry. And so the point is, none of these are exhaustive lists. No one's trying to say if I didn't call them by name, they weren't there. It's just that's how you make a list. You notice the people who maybe sit around you or who are notable to you. If there's someone you were surprised to see, someone that you were glad to see, that's the person you mentioned. And so that's the way these lists are. Questions on verse 1? That just comes up this time of year when people, when atheists write their pop culture pieces in the newspaper about, well, the gospel accounts don't even agree about who was there. Well, read them carefully. Questions on that? Good so far? Okay. Let's look at verses 2 through 4 then. Somebody wants to raise your hand and read that for us. Matthew 28, 2 through 4. No, I'm not going to let James do it, because James always does it. I'm not going to pick on him. Keith, thank you. How about that? I knew if I shamed you enough, somebody else would raise their hand. Matthew 28, 2 through 4. Thank you.
And behold, there was a great earthquake, for an angel of the Lord descended from heaven, came and rolled back the stone and sat on it. His appearance was like lightning, and his clothing white as snow. And for fear of him, the guards trembled and became like death.
A couple of details about the angel who is really highlighted here. Again, each of the gospel accounts is going to tell it just a little bit differently. So why does Matthew pick these details? The angel is described in more detail than some of the others. If we had a lot of time, we could go back and read Daniel chapter 10, I think, verses 4, 5, and 6. I'm not sure. You have to go look it up. But in Daniel, there's a description of the angel who spoke to Daniel and gave him his visions. And it's very similar to this. He has raiment. It's white as snow, and he comes down like lightning. It's very, very similar. And so that there might be some connection that for Matthew is very interested in kind of the Jewish aspect of this story and connecting it to the Old Testament. So he describes the angel and lets you know it was the same kind of angel that, you know, Daniel would have seen to kind of help you connect some dots maybe. But let me ask a couple of questions before we get to the number three there. When was the last time we saw an angel in the book of Matthew? Let me ask it differently. There are exactly two angel stories in the book of Matthew. This is one of them. What's the other one?
Matthew 4.
Oh, well, now you're cheating. I wasn't counting that one. Does it? Okay, that was what I was going for. The last time an angel had any lines, cheater. The last time an angel had any lines was in the birth story, right? So at the birth, angels come and they make an announcement, right? And then at the death, or at the resurrection rather, angel shows up and makes an announcement. At opposite ends of the book, right? So you could think of them as bookends, angels making an announcement about who is this we're talking about, okay? When was the last time we saw an earthquake in Matthew? Here again, as far as I know, unless James remembers more, there's exactly two earthquakes in the book of Matthew. This is one of them. What's the other? When Jesus dies, Matthew has a much lengthier paragraph. If you just want to flip back a page to chapter 27, verse 51. And behold, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook. The rocks were split. And then the tombs are emptied. Okay. So at the death of Jesus, we have an earthquake. So what I'm trying to point out is that Matthew has certain things that come up at big events. And he is helping you connect all of those things happen in the last chapter at the resurrection. We've got an announcement from an angel. The earth is shaking. This is this kind of thing that's supposed to get your attention. It all happens in just a verse or two, right? Each one of these have been an interesting story. You could add just a chapter about the earthquake, right? That would have been interesting. But it's just all of it kind of compressed together to let you know these are all things that happened at the time of the resurrection or at this particular moment after the resurrection to get your attention. In the same way the angel was getting your attention back in the early chapter, with an announcement, he's getting your attention here. In the same way the earthquake said something important just happened in the crucifixion, there's going to be an earthquake-like event here that gets your attention and says something important just happened. Pay attention. So these are Matthew's tools for helping you say, notice this. This is a big deal. Other questions or thoughts on verses 2 through 4? Still good? All right. Then let's read verses 5 through 7, if somebody wants to read that. Thank you, Denny. Didn't even wait for me to shame anybody.
And the angel answered and said unto the women, fear not ye, for I know that ye seek Jesus, which was crucified. He is not here, for he is risen, as he said. Come and see the place where the Lord lay.
And verse 7 as well. Thank you. So I'm very interested, especially here lately, in the way the Gospels tell the resurrection story, what they say and what they don't say. And when I say how the Gospel tells it, I want you to notice what Matthew, the narrator, says, and then what maybe some other person says. In the Gospel accounts, and I'm looking, James, you can correct me on this, but I'm going to pick on you all night now. I can't find Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John as a narrator ever saying, and then Jesus was resurrected. What they say is, some people went down there, they met someone, the angel says he is risen, and they went and looked, and he wasn't there. See that subtle difference? The Gospels are just giving you an account of what happened. They're working really hard. If they just come out and say, he's risen from the dead, he's resurrected, well, then now you're going to say, well, prove it. Did anybody see Jesus resurrected? The event of the resurrection? Nobody saw that, right? I mean, we even say, well, it happened Sunday morning. It was done by Sunday morning. When they get there Sunday morning, it's over. Okay? Does anyone see it? No? So the Gospels are just very careful, like really reliable history should be. And it just says, here's what happened. They went down there. They were expecting to see him. They saw somebody else. This other person had an explanation. And this is a believable person because it's not just a person, is it? It's an angel. So this is a very believable explanation. But then to make sure, they go and check, don't they? They always have them going inside and checking to see. So look at what the angel says. First of all, do not be afraid, which, by the way, is pretty much always what the angel says. In any angel story throughout the entire Bible, sentence number one is usually, hold on, don't be afraid. Because apparently angels are terrifying. I know for all of you that collect precious moments or something like that and have the little cute angels, I'm sorry. In the Bible, people are always terrified and they fall down before angels. And the angel says, don't be afraid. Okay. So the angel starts out, don't be afraid, but we're going to come back to that. Then he states a fact, just a fact. No explanation. He just says, here's a fact. He is not here. Then he makes a claim. He is risen. Now that one's going to require some proof, right? Because it's different. He's not here and he's up walking around are two very different things. Right? So first he makes a fact. This is a fact. You can go in here and check, and he's going to tell you to. He is not here. Second, he has risen. That's why he's not here. And then he invites them to come inspect it. Come look. Don't take my word for it. Come look. Okay? So again, I just like to point out that the claim being made by the text is as reserved as possible. It's not making an outrageous claim. I was listening to an atheist the other day who was giving a speech about how if you have an outrageous claim, then you've got to have outrageous evidence. And I just think it's interesting that the Gospels go out of their way to downplay it as much as possible. We're just going to tell you the facts. Just the facts, ma'am. Right? Just the facts. Here it is. They went. He wasn't there. They went and looked. He wasn't there. There was a shiny person there who said, let me tell you what happened. But the narrator is very careful to say, at this point, all I'm going to tell you is, he wasn't where he was supposed to be. See? What level of evidence does it require to prove he's not there? People said he wasn't there. I mean, that's a perfectly reasonable thing. If you were in a court of law and you had to prove that somebody wasn't in a casket, how would you prove that? You'd have some people who looked at the casket and said, he's not there. Right? So Matthew just says, step one, he's not here. We looked. Okay. Did you have a point, James, or were you?
Yeah, you have two battle-hardened Roman soldiers scared stiff.
Yeah. Yeah, now the Roman soldiers, they're especially interesting. They don't know what to think at all. Verse 4, for fear of him, the guards trembled and became like dead men. Which again, you've heard me say before, I think a lot of the Gospels have jokes built in, and this is one of them. They came to see a dead man, and they found some, but it was the guards. The dead men are the guards who are so scared of the angel, they became as dead men. Jesus isn't a dead man. That's not who they find. So I think it's Matthew telling you a joke. But anyway, you have these battle-hardened Roman guards who are scared to death. The angel says, don't be afraid. Let me just give you the facts. There's nobody here. Okay. What are the other possible explanations of an empty tomb? If we just stopped here, and I'm glad the gospel doesn't, okay? But if Matthew ended right there at the end of verse 7, the tomb is empty. He is not here. What are some other explanations? And they don't have to be good explanations. Just what are some explanations? Where else could he be?
Body is stolen.
Okay, grave robbers. That's not new, right? I mean, there have been grave robbers in the ancient world, so somebody could have taken him. Okay? In John 20, that's exactly what Mary Magdalene thinks. She talks to the person she thinks is the gardener and says, if you'll just tell me where they've taken my master, I'll go tend to it. Where have they taken him? Okay. What would be another alternative? And by grave robbers, I assume you mean they're looting the tomb or something like that. Why might somebody steal a body? It's a pretty short list of reasons, isn't it? There's not just a lot of things you can do with a dead body. If you want to disgrace Jesus of Nazareth, let's say you're the Pharisees and you want everybody to know that this man is dead, completely dead, then you might steal the body and put it on display. Is that what happens? I mean, all they have to do is trot out the body and it's over. Okay, they don't do that. Who else could have stole the body?
Disciples.
Now, this would be the most attractive option. If the disciples were trying to create the greatest con scheme in human history and convince the whole world that Jesus of Nazareth is risen when he's not, they would need to hide the body. What motivation do you suppose they'd have for doing that?
Verse 13.
That's exactly what the Pharisees are going to suggest. Let's start that story. Okay. What motivation would the disciples have for stealing the body of Christ and lying about it? What would they get out of it?
Fame and glory.
Fame and glory, right? Is that what happens to any of the disciples? No, they're tortured and murdered, right? By and large, they are impoverished, robbed, beaten, murdered. Some of them crucified. None of them get the fame and glory out of it. So it's really hard to understand what is their motivation if they're stealing the body? What do they get out of it? And how did they pull it off? Now you're going to get ahead of me just a minute, but you made a good point. In the end of this story, in verses 11 through 14, the guards come and say to the Pharisees, this is what happened. Pharisees say, no, we're going to tell you what happened. We've got a better story, and the story is, read verse 13 carefully. Tell the people, his disciples came by night and stole him away while we were asleep. Name one of many things that's wrong with that story.
Roman guards don't sleep on duty.
Number one, Roman guards don't sleep on duty. And if they do, they're in trouble. Do you remember the Philippian jailer? He thought the prisoners had escaped. And what was he ready to do? He was going to kill himself. He knew he's done. There's no second chance. Now, if that's true for a jailer of live men, what do you think for the people who let the dead person get away? Right? Yeah, I think their career as a Roman soldier has come to an end. So that doesn't make any sense. What else is wrong with that story? Who wins a fight between disciples and Roman soldiers? Remember, the disciples have all of the military experience involved in being great fishermen. Yeah, okay, so that doesn't make any sense. But that's fine because the Roman soldiers don't say that they fought them. What do the Roman soldiers say?
Slept.
We were sleeping. Now here's my question. What happened in your house while you were asleep last night? If you had to testify on the stand in a courtroom, I was asleep and here's what happened in my house, what do you think the judge might say to you? You were asleep. You don't get an opinion on that. You didn't see any of it. You were asleep. This is what happens once in a while. Lucas comes in and says, well, while I was sleeping, this is what happened. Stop right there. You don't get to tell me what happened while you were sleeping. You were asleep. And so you have Roman guards saying, we know what happened while we were sleeping, which, of course, they wouldn't have done. So it's just a strange story all the way around, and which is why Matthew kind of pokes a little fun at it later in the text. So the point is, so far in Matthew, he's been very careful. The angel's making all the big claims. Matthew, the narrator, is just saying, here's the facts. Tomb is empty. Don't have a lot of good explanations of that at this point. Okay? Somebody will read for us verses 8 through 10. Denny, you're a good man. Thank you.
And they departed quickly from the sepulchre.
Yep.
With fear and great joy, and did run to bring his disciples word. And as they went to tell the disciples, behold, Jesus met them, saying, all hail. And they came and held him by the said Jesus unto them, Be not afraid, go tell my brethren that they go into Galilee, and there they shall see me.
Thank you. One of the best things the ESV did was it stopped using the word sepulchre and started using the word tomb, and I'm so happy for that because I mispronounce sepulchre about every other time. Anyway, so they leave the tomb, and how does it describe them in verse 8? How are they feeling as they leave the tomb? Fear and great joy. Is that an odd combination? Can you think of a time in your life, I would have to work at it, when you felt fear and joy at the same time? That's exactly the one I was thinking of. For a lady, the birth of a child would probably be the closest to it. I am very excited about the thing that is terrifying me right now, right? Is that kind of how motherhood feels like there at that first moment or two, right? Fatherhood kind of feels like that without the pain and the, you know, all the good stuff y'all get. We do have a moment of terror when they hand us the baby. When Lucas was born, there was a problem with Celine at the same time, and so the nurse wanted to get back to Celine really quickly. And so I was there kind of in a daze, you know, like first-time fathers are, and the nurse says, here, and baby. And suddenly this little creature is in my hand, and I was terrified that I was going to drop him, first of all, because I was not at all prepared to be handed baby, and then here he is. And off they go to go do something with Celine. So there was a little bit of fear, and I suspect on Celine's end, as they're concerned about her medical health during that ordeal, the fear and the joy, she wants to be very happy about the baby. She doesn't let me show anyone the pictures of the birth of either kids, of the first picture with baby and mama, because she has this look on her face of complete terror. And here's, you know, the bundle of joy, and I'm smiling. And she's there in terror and getting over pain. She says, this isn't me at my best. So that's maybe the closest I can think of to just terror and joy all at the same moment, maybe, would be something like childbirth. You know it's really good, and it's really scary. So that's maybe not a bad analogy for what has just happened. It's really good, we think, and it's really scary. Does that sound like a really authentic description of how you would have felt at that particular moment? I really think so. To me, it gives the gospel some credibility. If they just go on their way and they just accept it and move on and say, oh, well, of course the tomb's empty and they're not fazed by that, I think something is fishy here. If they say, oh, of course he's risen from the dead. But no, they are struck at the same time by joy and terror. Thrilled and terrified at the same time. They're told again, do not be afraid. That's what the angel said. Now Jesus says it. Why does Jesus have to tell them not to be afraid? Stephen?
He's alive.
Because he's alive, right? I mean, this is not a natural thing. When I read books sometimes and they say, well, you know, ancient people had these superstitions and they were gullible and all that. Are you crazy? Ancient people knew that dead people stayed dead. Ancient people know if they walk into somebody that was dead not very long ago, something is very, very a matter. Something's very wrong. And he, in human form, has to give them the same instruction the angel with the lightning and the earthquake had to give them, because they are just as shocked to see Jesus as they were the angel. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared. Okay? This is a good thing. So that answers question number one, why would they be afraid of Jesus? Question number two requires a little bit of thought. In all four accounts, the women are there first, and then the women go and get the apostles, and the apostles end up being the witnesses of the resurrection. So if you read 1 Corinthians chapter 15, 3 through 8, thereabout, it gives the list of the witnesses of the resurrection, and it gives the names of the 12 apostles and the people who saw him, and so forth. So that's the official list of witnesses. The apostles are going to do their job. But in all four accounts, women go and get the apostles. What's interesting about that detail?
They were there to take care of
Okay, so it's something that makes sense to us, right? That it's part of the story that makes sense. They were there for a perfectly boring, ordinary reason. They had intended to take care of the body before, but it was Sabbath and you can't do that. And so they come back early Sunday morning to do what they intended to do Friday night. So they have a reason to be there. If there's somebody that's there that has no reason to be there, this story is kind of a strange story. I don't know if I believe it, but we have a perfectly legitimate reason for the women to be there. In the ancient world, it may not surprise you to find out that the testimony of women is not as highly trusted as the testimony of men. So if you were inventing a fictional story, who would have been your first witnesses? The most trustworthy people you could find. But all four gospel accounts say that the first people were these women who were there for perfectly ordinary reasons. Which to me, again, has the feel of a very believable story. They don't change the facts to make it more believable, right? In all four accounts, the women who are there doing perfectly ordinary things are the first people to find out. And they go and they convey that information to the apostles. And then the apostles, who are going to be the listed witnesses to be called to account later on, they come. Peter comes, John comes, and they inspect the tomb. Thomas finds him later, but they take a look. But first, always the women. 4 minutes, let me see if I can make my point. I have heard this particular part of the story both ignored and exaggerated, so let me try to split the difference here. People who want to advocate for women in pulpit work will say, see, the first people to preach about Jesus were women. And that to me seems like a bit of a stretch. Is that what happened here? Yeah. They were there for perfectly ordinary reasons. They turn around and they go get the disciples, right? I mean, it's a fairly low-key story in that sense. You don't have, they aren't getting up in the middle of the synagogue and telling everybody, let me tell you what happened, right? Their job is to go and find the disciples who are then going to do exactly that 50 days later in the temple steps. They're going to preach a sermon, but these ladies do not. So I think that's a huge exaggeration to take that point in that direction. That said, would you say that women have a role in the world that comes about after the resurrection? I would say certainly they do, right? They aren't ignored. They're an important part of the story. They are, without them, the disciples can't do their job because no one bothers to look, right? They have a huge part of the story, and they are told in all four gospel accounts. And so I would stay away from the exaggeration that says, therefore, you know, women in pulpit ministry. But I would say that, yeah, that what you see in the last chapters of all four Gospels and in the first chapter of Acts is that women were involved in active ways, in appropriate ways, in the early church. And that's what you come to expect when you read the Gospel in the book of Acts.
Weren't they, in fact, asked by the angel to do that?
Yep.
The angel didn't say, go get the disciples and bring them back so I can tell them what happened.
Yeah.
He sent
You tell them.
And
yeah.
You tell them what I told you. So.
Yeah, the angel doesn't speak to the apostles. Yeah, that was the lady's job. So I think they have an enormous job. I don't think this means that you throw out what Paul will write later about the difference between men and women in the work of the church. But it does mean that men and women have work in the church. I would go that far. What does the action of the women in verse 9 imply about how they now view Jesus? What do they do in verse 9? I mentioned this morning. Someone said it. They fall at his feet. What does Thomas do when he sees Jesus after the resurrection? Falls at his feet. My Lord and my God. Okay. So they recognize that whatever they believed before, and I think they believed in Jesus before, but whatever they believed in Jesus before wasn't enough. That after the resurrection, they now realize that they didn't know the half of it. And now something radically different has been made clear. Or as Romans chapter 1 verse 4 would say, he is declared to be the Son of God with power by the resurrection. Right? This is a moment where something has been not changed. I don't think he suddenly becomes the Son of God. but he is declared to be the Son of God in a way more forceful than ever before. And when people see it, they just want to fall down at his feet. Okay, I intended to go the rest of that few verses, but we're out of time. Appreciate your comments and thoughts.